I wanted to know what you thought as a cosmetic surgeon, what new advancements there might have been in the recent past that the public is unaware of because of the fact that there's so much press related to the laser treatments and et cetera.
Well, let me say this. I was just picking up a little throwaway magazine. You're talking about laser treatments. Long redness and hyperpigmentation in the 2 to 8% range are honest. Why then are the rest of us out there seeing so many more patients with badly damaged faces and necks? Angry, litigious patients who are still bright red 3 months after, despite adequate pre- and post-operative skin preparation. It's just a little comment that was made by one of the surgeons about a recent meeting we had in New York. Essentially, what's happening is that the laser is really something that burst on us with great vigor and vim and all this sort of business. For the most part, unfortunately, it's being somewhat overused. Overused because it's an item that anybody, whether they be a plastic surgeon or otherwise, can get a hold of, or they're using it to do things that they really shouldn't do. In other words, they're trying to shrink the skin down enough by the use of the laser to, in effect, achieve a facelift, which it definitely doesn't do. So that's one aspect of the laser that's it's really becoming very, very important. And for all of us, those of us who see lots of complications and problems from that horrible old place called elsewhere, it really is becoming a very worrisome item.
I'm very aware of the fact that there are many people who do things you're not qualified to do because they see the money involved in it.
What we're doing then as far as changes in the field, let's leave laser out of the picture for the moment. The major changes in the field are philosophic changes together with some degree of technique changes. By philosophic changes, I mean this, that 20 years ago, you saw a person in their, say, early 40s, and pretty much invariably you'd say, look, go away, come back, when you've really got a lot of sag. The current thinking nowadays is more toward, well, let's do a little stitch in time saves nine philosophy. We're getting the patients younger and younger. We're doing a little bit of work. In other words, not a full facelift. We'll probably do either an endoscopic brow lift or a temporal lift or an extended mini lift. Any of those techniques, and we're using those in order to obviate the need for the patient, A, having to delay and begin to look old and begin to look worried, B, having to have such a major procedure for the first or even second time around. So in essence, it means that we get someone in their early 40s, they have a extended mini lift, maybe an endoscopic brow lift, which is something that will have them out of social and other activities just for a matter of days, you know, at the most probably a week. Patient is then back looking not too much different from what they were before. They just look fresh, refreshed, as though they've just come back from the spa. They'll stay looking pretty good for several years, meaning anywhere between 5 to 10 years. They then come in. They may then need the major lift, depending on the amount of aging they've been scheduled for, or alternatively, they may just get away with another mini. Now, we're finding that the patients who are doing this on are much, much happier. They're not being A, extended out for a prolonged period of time, aging, and visibly aging. The kind of comments they're getting from their friends and associates is, gee, you look wonderful, you never seem to get any older, I don't know what you're doing.
Is this, by the way, inpatient?
Oh, a lot of this we can do outpatient now, dependent on the extent of surgery. So these patients are frequently just coming in the morning, leaving in the afternoon. Always, nonetheless, in my practice at least, in hospital. I'm not a great lover of the outpatient facilities in doctor's offices, not for any reason that they're terribly badly run in many instances, but just that if there is a little bit of a blip in one way or another, you've got the full facilities of a hospital behind you. I prefer hospital settings for that reason. It's a rarity, but every now and then. I mean, I had a patient just the other day, a healthy woman, no problems, no worries, no troubles. Came in, and by all accounts it should have been just a simplistic, straightforward procedure. She had a rather unusual reaction to a commonly used narcotic that we have, and we just had to have the anesthesia people in, we had to have the patient stay overnight and so on.
Complications can occur.
Yeah, complications can and do occur. It's something that was a relatively minor complication as such because the patient was in hospital, but on the other hand, if it had been in a doctor's office, I'd have been significantly worried.
In fact, if I could ask you a question about that, regarding complications that occur in the case histories that you take with clients, patients beforehand, I'm sure that you ask them what they're taking, et cetera.
Oh,
is hormonal replacement or the birth control pill or any other type of medications a problem?
Not generally. The problems we run up against are, number one, vitamin E, heavy dose of vitamin E. We like patients not to take that for 2 weeks prior.
Let's say someone's a very big exerciser. Would you suggest that they stay away from severe exercise?
After the operation, yeah. After the operation, we normally have them stay away from exercise for a period of 6 weeks. When I say stay away, that means being in a full exercise program. What we normally do is we let them walk as much as they want to within 2 or 3 days. We don't encourage jogging because it bounces the facial muscles. We keep them off jogging for a period of 6 to 8 weeks. They can do lower body exercise after a couple of weeks, and in general, they're not in bad shape, but it's just the upper torso that we like them not to either bounce or perform any heavy-duty exercise.
And regarding someone who has, let's say, exercised the night before or the morning of, let's say, the surgeries in the afternoon?
No, we don't like them doing it on the morning of. Night before, I have no problem with it.
Sleeping habits. Have you ever had a patient where you said to yourself, they didn't get enough sleep, this is not going to do well?
If you come in a rested state, not agitated and so on, you certainly seem to do better and quicker.
Absolutely. And regarding, you just said drug data, would their bodies wouldn't heal as well, or they may not be confident?
We find the people who are heavy drinkers, I like to put off and put them once on the wagon necessarily, but certainly cut down the amount of alcohol they partake for at least a week to 10 days beforehand.
Absolutely, I can understand that.
And nothing to drink for 2 weeks after that. If they want to get back to it, that's their problem.
Right. Is there anything else pre-op or post-op that you suggest to people?
I usually put, if they're not already taking vitamins, I usually put them on just any old multivitamin over the counter for a period of 3 weeks beforehand.
Because some doctors don't want people to be on any vitamins at all.
I don't think it makes any difference if it's just a regular over-the-counter vitamin.
Mm-hmm.
The only ones I'm against, of course, is vitamin E for 2 weeks prior, because it definitely does lead to bruising. But apart from that, I'm a great believer in vitamin E.
What would you say the ratio of problem results would be in your industry?
It varies very much from surgeon to surgeon. And we've got published rates of, say, hematoma, which is a bruising, heavy bruising after a facelift. Some cases, they're published incidence as high as 10%. My own practice, I've got about 0.05%. In other words, half of 1% is the number of hematomas I get.
That's because of your skill, of course.
It's just skill and care and how extensive you are in terms of undermining and, you know, care to stop bleeding and so on, and also preparation of patients.
Are there patients that you wouldn't take because of a certain type of skin, either too light or...
No, for just regular cosmetic surgery, meaning facelifts, eyelidplasties, I don't really have any inhibitions on that subject. Although the patient who's got, you know, very, very crepey skin, very, very thin skin, you've got to be inordinately careful about. Each patient, you'll give them some idea of what kind of correction they can achieve.
Okay, so what they can achieve. They may not see it, know that they wouldn't get the perfect result. And I'm talking about regarding what they would want because of their skin type.
Oh, yes, it's lack of realistic expectation. You get some lady who's spent, or man for that matter, who's spent their waking moments on the beach in Florida, and they come up with the idea that they're going to end up with a baby smooth skin again. Well, you've got to just dissuade them from that viewpoint.
Or, you know, it depends on how they heal, too.
Oh, yeah. But in essence, you're never going to get the kind of result on an old fried skin that you are on a person who's been careful and sun-scared.
I think a lot of that has to do with moisture content and elasticity, too.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And also who you chose for your parents.
That's right.
That's really probably the most important factor.
That's very, very true. What about men? Are a lot of men having more procedures?
The number of men is increasing significantly. The reason being, of course, the downsizing of industry and the man who's in his, I'll say, early mid-40s. And he's not at the very top of the pole as far as his industry goes. he's always starting to look over his shoulder at that stage and think, oh gosh, I'm not advancing as fast as I might. Frequently they'll erroneously, in many instances, blame their appearance for lack of progress. But on the other hand, if someone says to that kind of person, gee, you look a little old, immediately there starts the thought process is working. Gosh, am I old? There's going to be some young guy they're going to have coming up the ladder who's going to get it just not because he's any better than me, but just because he looks younger than me.
That's a very good point.
And particularly in the sales industry, of course, that's a major factor.
But I like how you said that they can blame their appearance when it really has to do with so much more.
Oh, yeah.
But that's part of it, of course. See, do they heal faster? Do they heal differently?
Men in general tend to heal not quite as fast as the ladies because they've got a thicker skin, you know, with all the beard and so on that's inherent to the skin. And it tends to bleed more. They tend to get more bruising. And they tend to be somewhat slower in losing their swelling.
As far as women in swelling, I know that my aunt had a facelift and that it took 6 months before her face looked a little bit normal.
It's not usual. I mean, in general, I would say to my patients that you're going to look presentable enough to go out to a restaurant, have dinner after a couple of weeks.
I guess what I want to do is try to compare it to the laser treatments.
Well, in essence, it depends on the depth of laser treatment. I would say that there's very, very few of my patients that aren't willing to go back to work or, you know, non-important social activity after 2 weeks. On the other side of the coin, for the laser patients, the way I treat them with laser.
Oh, you also do laser?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not a great enthusiast with it. I'm very, very selective in who I take laser on with. But with those patients, I'd say you're looking at a good 4 weeks before they're really happy to go back into social and work activities.
So for laser, you think it takes longer for someone to be presentable?
Well, they're presentable with heavy makeup after 2 weeks, no doubt about that. You've got the patient who says, gee, I don't like wearing heavy makeup. It makes me look different.
Right.
And indeed it does.
So in the case of a facelift, you're pulling the skin back and you're cutting it off. In laser, aren't you also burning the skin off?
In the case of the laser, you're burning the surface layers off.
Oh, it doesn't cut like right through to a certain level and then the skin is pulled over with stitching?
No. You can use the laser as a cutting device, there's no doubt about that, but there's no real advantage to gain in that.
Okay, I didn't realize that it was only
surface. When I'm talking about laser, I'm talking about laser resurfacing.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm aware of. I wasn't aware of the cutting.
No, we often do use the laser for cutting. The old technique that my old partner John Converse and I developed, oh gosh, way back in 1961 or thereabouts, that's the so-called no-incision eyelid plasty, the eyelid plaster. We make the cut inside the lid rather than on the outside. We originally developed that using a knife. Then we went from the knife to the diathermy scalpel. That's the electric cautery scalpel. Then when the laser became available, we began to use the laser for it. But honestly, there's not all that much difference in healing rate between the laser cutting and the plain ordinary old scalpel cut.
Can there be, from the method that you do, as well as the damage to the nerve or paralysis event, of some sort as a side effect, a risk factor?
Always a potential risk from a practical viewpoint in the hands of a competent surgeon. It should be near zero.
Are there any other side effects that occur that I would not be aware of besides hyperpigmentation?
Well, with facelifting, there's the major complication, if you want to put it, it really isn't truly a complication, it's an expected happening, is that you do have numbness in your face. That persists for a period of time. I've had a facelift a couple of years ago, and now after about 6-9 months, I was practically back to normal as far as sensibility of face goes, but certainly for the first 6 months or so, I was significantly numb in that area, and that's a norm for patients.
And do you think that happens with laser as well?
No, the laser, you've just got a little diminution of sensation, but not significantly.
Well, that's good to know, but they still can't take all that skin off, and that's a fact.
No, the laser, you've just got a little diminution of sensation, but not significantly.
Well, that's good to know, but they still can't take all that skin off, and that's a fact.
No, I mean, if you've got too much skin, there's only one way to take care of it, and that's with a facial plasty operation.
Right, right. I understand that. Let me just see. If someone wants to prevent themselves from having, let's say they're researching to find a great doctor.
My suggestion is that people call the American Board of Plastic Surgery.
And then you can see if someone has a bad track record?
The American Board of Plastic Surgery gives out, shall we say, culled out recommendations.
Rather than purchase, like anyone can belong to a certain society, it's their honest recommendations?
Oh, yeah.
And do you also do fat transplants?
No, I don't do fat transplants at all. I tend to limit myself just to things that I'm happy with and, you know, really, really experienced in.
If someone has, like, a puffy type of bag, would you say that the laser would be a better way to go?
Laser's definitely not a better way to go, in that it won't take the puffiness away. You've got to, the only one way of taking care of the puffiness is to actually surgically remove the little puffs of fat. That can be done either by the method that I mentioned to you before of inside the eyelid, where there's not much excess skin. That's principally in the younger patient. Or it's done with a classic incision on the outside of the eyelid.
All right, so it's in or outside the eyelid with a small incision.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can understand that. Are there any other type of cosmetic therapy that I should be aware of?
The collagen itself, the old classical collagen, is an animal product that's purified and so on. There's a new substance that's just coming on the market now. What you do there is that when you're doing a facelift on a patient, of course you've got skin that's a byproduct of it that you've excised. And you can send this skin away to these people who are up in Boston. They will process the collagen out for you and send it back to you in ampoules, which can be injected into the patient.
My goodness.
Obviously, your chance of getting a successful take of collagen incorporation is better if you're using your own rather than some old cows or bulls.
In terms of doing someone's eyes, how would you pick the shape of their eyes?
We aim never to change the actual shape, the aperture shape. All we're doing is, and in point of fact, it's kind of difficult to change that aperture. All we're doing is, in effect, we're changing the surroundings, that is, the excess of skin or the fatty pads.
And also skin.
They're really fatty herniations, just like a belly hernia and abdominal hernia. You get a herniation of fat up there around your eyes.
So what about if someone's heavy versus someone who's thin? Are they a better candidate? Are they more...
In general, the fatter you are, the less satisfactory candidate you are, as a generalization.
Why would that be?
Oh, they just seem to heal a little slower. They tend to swell a little more.
Okay, but not so much as the direct result?
No, I mean, the fat just seems to slow down the healing and give more swelling.
And by the way, if someone is diabetic, can they still have a treatment?
Very, very leery. I do very, very few diabetics. I do some, but only with the greatest of caution and